Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and today we'll be talking about thought transference, the uncanny dimension of the mind, and why psychoanalysis is more like a magical spell than it is like a science. There's always those few points in your life where you stop and go, stuff. This is really weird here. Like, I'm not really sure what box to put this in, And I tend to resist kind of embracing paranormal ideas or phenomena with too much gusto. Like, I always have a grain of salt somewhere, and sometimes it dissolves, but it usually comes back pretty quickly. But one thing that I've noticed throughout my life on many, many, many occasions, mostly on the street corners of New York City and San Francisco, but also occasionally when I've had the unfortunate experience of having to be with people who are having serious psychological breaks, is that there's this strange thing that happens where it almost feels like folks who are clearly schizophrenic or having some kind of psychotic break, and I'm thinking mostly of these characters on the streets of New York City and San Francisco, and you can be walking by, and you're just thinking about whatever. You're thinking about what you're going to say to your boss. You're thinking about your girlfriend. You're thinking about some problem in the history of philosophy. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times it's happened where some dude will come over and go, "Oh yeah, your girlfriend, I wouldn't do that if I were you." And you're like, "How? What?" I'm like, no, that must have just been a coincidence. But it's happened so many times to me that I'm completely convinced that whatever state of mind so many homeless people get into or are in and hence leads to their homelessness, that there's a strange kind of slippage in thought information there that I'm not really sure what to do with. But it's one of those weird things. I don't really talk about it. I don't think about it very much. It happens, then I remember it, and then I forget about it again because it doesn't. I have nowhere to put it. Where do I put this? Like, homeless people are telepathic. I don't know. It was a coincidence. It just happened to be that I was thinking about exactly the same word that they said to me when they looked at me in the eye and said, "No, don't do it," or whatever it was. So I was really happy to stumble across this idea of extensive and very interesting discussion of this phenomena in Makita Brautmann's new book, Phantoms of the Clinic, along with a lot of other very interesting discussions about psychoanalysis, its relationship to thought transference, kind of the hidden paranormal mystical side of the therapy situation, particularly in its psychoanalytic guise. So I'm really happy that we're going to have Makita on the show today for the second time. But before we bring her on, of course, it's time for our co-host, Maja Daou, the White Witch of LA, calling in. How are you doing, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Have you ever had a weird experience in it with the homeless person, like kind of what I'm talking about?
Oh, man. So mine have been so epic, just like you were talking about, to the point where there was one where I literally had a song stuck in my head, and then this old black woman, I got eye contact with her, and she started singing the song that was in my head.
Wow, man, that totally blows. I mean, I can't even really remember most of mine because they're so peripheral, but that blows me away.
It was epic.
That's amazing stuff. So,
yeah.
Well, this should be good. Anyway, let's bring Makita on because she's fun to talk to. So, hi, Makita.
Hi there, Eric and Maja. How are you?
Very good. You're calling. You're in Baltimore at the moment?
Baltimore, right.
You fled the West Coast of all the
it was too much
goony,
for me.
The goony New Agers, and now you're back in a nice, crusty East Coast city.
That's right.
Wonderful. Well, I'm really curious about this book. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful things you talk about in it, but it's also like important to say from the get-go that in addition to being a writer and a professor and a cultural critic, that you're also a psychoanalyst yourself, which gives a kind of interesting twist because in some ways you're kind of you know, peeling back the hidden, you know, the surface to expose the hidden secret, that there's a lot of paranormal weirdness, uncanny phenomena and related material kind of beneath the surface of the supposedly modern kind of psychoanalytic situation. So I'm curious, just like as a psychoanalyst, what brought you to this book and these topics?
Well, you know, in some ways, psychoanalysis as a profession is virtually obsolete. What happened to me is when I was an undergraduate at Oxford, I was kind of, you know, going through some emotional upheaval, as many undergraduates do. And I'd never been in therapy, and I'd never seen any kind of clinician. I'd never taken any kind of pharmaceutical medication or anything like that. And I saw an ad in on one of the university notice boards that had been placed there by a retired elderly psychoanalyst who was willing to take on a student free in analysis, just to kind of keep his hand in at the end of his life. And I ended up going to see this gentleman 3 times a week for about 3 years, the whole time I was an undergraduate. And this was my first introduction to anything therapeutic. So I didn't realize that what we're doing was very unusual and abnormal in the world of therapy. I would lie on a couch. It was in his house. I would lie on a couch. He would say very little. And I'm not quite sure whether or not it helped. It wasn't really about being helped. I was really fascinated by the kind of relationship that developed between us. I was terrified of him. I kind of loved him. I dreaded him. It was a very charged emotional situation that was way beyond that that I'd experienced before with anyone, including my own family. So I was really fascinated by that. And when later on in life I trained as an analyst myself, it's that experience that I wanted to recreate, that kind of magical experience of that's much more ritualistic than it is clinical, the low lighting, the heavy fabrics, the couch. And it was a real disappointment to me when I realized how obsolete that was and how most, there are around 65,000 clinical psychologists in the U.S. today and hundreds of thousands of therapists of various stripes, but only around 3,000 psychoanalysts. So it's really for various reasons becoming obsolete. But it was the sort of mystical shadow side of psychoanalysis that I was most interested in recapturing for myself.
So tell me if I'm right, it's almost that psychoanalysis in the 20th century wanted to establish itself as a science. And so for a long time, and you kind of tell the story in your book, they sort of kept some of this more ambivalent, ambiguous, dream-like material, this kind of mysterious realm that seemed to be invoked in this kind of almost ritualistic ceremony of the encounter in order to get, you know, official creds and to be, you know, a professional, modern, you know, high-income person. But at this point in the game, with the rise of neuroscience and new psychological forms, that basically that attempt is an utter failure. In some ways, you're like bringing it back. It's like, well, let's look at all that stuff that we had that people weren't really talking about.
Yeah, and it started with Freud. I mean, Freud, whatever people might think of him, did some fascinating work to do with, like, he wrote a paper on dreams and telepathy, and he wrote about dreams and occultism. He wrote about the relationship between psychoanalysis and telepathy, and it was very much involved with the spiritualist movement at the turn of the century in Britain and in the U.S., but he was discouraged by his collaborators, specifically Ernest Jones, from going any further into this area because everyone was afraid that psychoanalysis would turn out to be, would be associated with, you know, fortune-telling and ghosts and spiritualism. And it was already really dodgy with all this emphasis on childhood sexuality and hysterical women and the body, that it was already shrouded in taboo. And so Freud was really pressured into, letting this ball drop. But he says, even late in his life, he said that if he'd could have lived his life again, he would have devoted it to investigating psychic phenomena rather than psychoanalysis. So it was always a real interest of his. And then after his death, the psychoanalytic movement just became increasingly scientific and sort of instrumental and legitimate, yet you always get this other side of it, like pushing its, like a mole pushing its snout through the soil, trying to get through. And there's been some really interesting figures that I write about in the book, like Jule Eisenberg, and, you know, various other psychiatrists and psychoanalysts who would not let go of this kind of shadow side of psychoanalysis. And it's a kind of, it's really taboo in mainstream psychoanalysis, and yet it's always there, and you can't get rid of it.
Well, and it's important, too, to remember the roots of it. I mean, like you said, just even Freud's inception, but something I always like to bring up, too, is, like, really one of the modern progenitors of psychoanalysis and psychology was Anton Mesmer. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of what Mesmer did started the whole, like, kind of patient-psychiatrist relationship. And he did it through hypnotism, which was developed by James Braid and based on mesmerism, and through influence and sway that the, you know, that the analyst has over the patient. And that relate telepathic connection is all the mesmerist stuff. And every single kind of concept that modern psychology comes from, you can sort of relate it to his early works on animal magnetism. And, you know, people have completely eradicated that part of the
history.
Yeah,
that's right. That's really interesting. Because, I mean, in the modern clinical situation where you get, you know, a therapist in a sort of very bland office sitting, chatting face-to-face with a patient, all of that magic and magnetism is disappeared. There's nothing particularly special about the therapeutic personality. It's simply a chat, giving some tips, perhaps writing a prescription, and all of that idea of the analyst as a kind of sage and the magnifying force of personality has disappeared. And and that's, I find that very disappointing. Although I think perhaps it's gone elsewhere.
I mean,
so
what's
another example of the way in which, you know, I'm just so fascinated in this time, you know, when we think about Freud, and Freud is such like a, you know, the seminal figure, even if people have kind of increasingly don't look at him as a scientist, he's still this you know, incredibly, you know, important force in terms of creating stories for how we organize our own experience, our dream life, our relationships to people. But even he was really immersed in these things. What were some of the experiences that he had, or that led him to be interested in thought transference and other kinds of paranormal activity?
Well, he said that he himself personally didn't have any of these experiences, but he encountered other people who had so many of them that he couldn't stop being fascinated by them. So he had so many patients who'd had sort of precognitive dreams, dreams that seemed to come true, or patients who'd visit fortune tellers and the fortune teller seemed to have told the truth, or patients who seemed to have predicted the future, that he had so many of these experiences that he couldn't dismiss it as, you know, coincidence. And in fact, he, in his prescriptions for what psychoanalysis involves, he kind of writes a prescription for these conditions, so having low lights and the couch and quiet. He's sort of creating conditions for the emergence of magic, or at least of magical thinking. And just the way that in, you know, if you read some of his studies in hysteria, the idea that speaking a name or a word can produce physiological effects in the body is really the same as a magic spell, you know, the key word that will open the lock. Later on, other analysts like Shandor Ferenczi and Jule Eisenberg talked about how they themselves actually had some of these occult experiences with their patients, where patients would be able to, like you were saying, Eric, with the schizophrenics on the street, kind of have some sort of paranormal ability to sort of ferret out what you're thinking, and in the analytic case, what the analyst is thinking. But Freud himself never experienced any of those at all.
But maybe you should tell us a little bit more about what that analytic situation is, because it helps to understand what the whole mechanism of transference is supposed to be in the encounter in the psychoanalytic ritual, if you will. Because then the arguments you make about what's actually going on there, why there might be these sort of leakages of thought. Thoughts and images make a little bit more sense.
Yeah, I mean, if you just think about the way that psychoanalysis was originally set up by Freud, the analyst himself, and they were all male at the beginning, you know, was supposed to behave as a kind of an adept or a sage. So the patient would know nothing about the analyst, would know nothing about his personal or private life, would often hardly ever get a glimpse of him, would come into the room and lie on the couch, and the analyst would be behind the couch and out of sight. There might be low candles or perhaps incense in the room. In my book, I've included lots and lots of pictures of Freud's consulting rooms because I just wanted to show what a difference there is between that kind of atmosphere and the modern clinic. I mean, Freud would have all kinds of figurines that he'd collected in his travels, gods, icons, strange kind of ritualistic objects, paintings, little gods, wooden panels, beautiful thick carpets and thick fabrics hanging on the wall. So it was really like a church or a crypt almost, and then there'd be this sort of sage-like figure sitting out of sight who might occasionally offer an interpretation or encourage further discussion or elicit a dream. And the setting was really intended for a lowering of consciousness so that the ordinary kind of social concerns of the everyday world, like face-to-face communication, all the kinds of guards we put up and all this kind of social niceties of ordinary polite behavior would disappear, and two people could communicate in a way that was unusually intimate. There's a modern psychoanalyst who I really like called Adam Phillips, and he said that psychoanalysis is what happens when you get two people in a room together and are as intimate as possible without having sex. You know, what else is there that you can do? Another way of getting that intimate without any kind of physical contact between the two people. And it's a way of intimacy that we're just not accustomed to thinking about, except perhaps in, you know, it happens in some kind of New Age practices like meditation and so on. But, yeah, I mean, the whole setup was intended to lower the resistances so that there could be this sort of uncanny communion of minds. And I think that whenever, I mean, that's what's going on, again, I think, with the schizophrenics on the street, is all of those conventional niceties are stripped away. And that leaves a kind of, in some ways, there's like a cognitive deficit there, and that allows a vacuum for these repressed, some kind of primitive conduits of knowledge to open up and to operate.
Well, it's true, and I mean, the effect of environment on that is like so pertinent. I mean, like you were saying, just setting up a sexy lounge type of thing is going to make people feel less self-conscious. I mean, the whole thing with, you know, if you're going to have sex with someone and it's in this like brightly neon lit room, you know, it's going to be way different than if you're in this kind of cavey, dark environment.
Yeah. And if you don't see a therapist today, you probably see a receptionist. You sit in a waiting room. You probably have to fill out scads of paperwork. You have to photocopy your insurance card. I mean, it's all...
But there's no intimacy.
Right. And it's nothing to do with... Yeah, it's nothing to do with intimacy. It's more to do with, like, the mechanics and science of everyday... instrumental everyday administration and everyday life. You're going for your allotted 20 minutes with a guy behind a desk and your insurance will pay for it. And, you know, there's none of that connection of minds, at least with most therapeutic encounters, have just been robbed of that numinous quality that Freud was so fascinated by.
Do you think that by bringing forward this aspect of psychoanalysis, this more almost At one point, you describe it to be like a magic act in the sense that it's kind of a ritual to produce astonishment, meaning those sort of incredibly affective glimpses that we sometimes have into our own workings, into the nature of the world. Do you think that by possibly reframing it in this way that doesn't try to pretend that it's the same thing as this instrumental, brightly lit, cognitive science-driven mechanism of so much therapy these days, that it has a hope of kind of like reviving itself? Or are you almost more just sort of interested in telling a story that needed to be told all along?
I think the whole structure of the scientific and medical establishment is such that there's no hope of reviving Freud's original intention of psychoanalysis. And as I said before, psychoanalysis is almost so obsolete now that, I just can't imagine any differences. But there are people, I'm lying right now on my fabric-lined couch in my low-lit office. There are people who continue this tradition. The problem is, the way that insurance works, insurance isn't going to pay for 50-minute sessions of psychoanalysis three times a week. But I think in some ways this has traveled over into the resurgence of interest in transpersonal therapy and Jungian analysis. And I know there's a kind of, and that kind of crosses over with a lot of other things like meditation and yoga. And I think that's where this impulse has gone. Although, I think it sort of loses that spooky, numinous quality by being brought out into the open, because there's a lot of darkness in it too. I mean, one of the reasons why psychoanalysis can't be revived, I think, is because, what Freud said about the original aim of psychoanalysis was to turn hysterical unhappiness into everyday misery. And, who's going to go around hoping that they can find everyday misery? I mean, it just doesn't sell. It's not sexy. People want a cure. They want to be made better. They want to be happier. They don't want a process that will perhaps lead them more deeply into their depression, or show them that grief or melancholy or mourning is the appropriate way for a human to behave in certain situations. I mean, it's just completely anathema to the sort of positive psychology movement that seems to have taken over all that way of thinking.
Well, now instead of doing that, people just take drugs, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
What do you think is happening to those shadows? As we move into this, even as the world around us is filled with more and more reasons for, fear and anxiety, and things are changing so fast, and nothing that we, there's very little to hold on to, and there's all of these monstrous technological, biomedical mutations on the horizon. At the same time, we have all of this positive psychology, we have all this sort of like, how to be happy, and like, if you eat right and do this, you're going to, be able to have that kind of courage and all that kind of upbeat sort of therapy culture. What's happening to all of those darker spirits that animated in so many ways give our lives meaning? I mean, they're not just in our heads. I mean, they're in the world somewhere, but what's happening with that?
I think, personally, I think that they manifest themselves in things like, the collapse of the banking system, in wars, in global depressions. I mean, I think that that's the outlet. We refuse to allow them into our personal lives, and they manifest themselves culturally and globally.
Yeah, the whole question of meaning through exploring the dark is something that I know, it's important to a lot of your work, because you look at pathology, you look at the cultural pathologies as a site, as a way of understanding deeper dynamics in us, in society, but also as a way to kind of bring those things back into the fold as something worth looking at, as something important to look at. And I'm just kind of curious how you see psychoanalyst analysis or therapy in general as being a way to whatever open up to that that kind of dark side of ourselves or of the world that is nonetheless so important to a deeper sense of life?
You know, it always has been. I mean, that's been the, and that was the intention of the original psychoanalyst. And I think it still is. You know, you can still get very good therapists and analysts who are interested in, who are not interested in, for example, getting rid of someone's depression or ignoring their unhappiness or medicating their unhappiness. And there's nothing wrong with medication, but there are certain areas of depression that need to be investigated, that are crying out to be investigated, and that are actually pretty fascinating. I was just discussing with some of my students this, you know, that essay by Mark Deary on the pathological sublime, and this notion that that the sublime, that you can actually find something sublime in the aesthetic qualities of wounds and scars and diseases, but also in the darkness of the human mind as well. There are places that you can go to and that explore that might seem really frightening on the surface, but the further you get into them, the more you can appreciate their kind of, that they have a kind of aesthetic quality, that if you can activate your own curiosity, you can set aside the judging part of your mind and the frightened part of your mind and just think, you know, yes, for example, I am feeling suicidal. Isn't that curious? Isn't this an interesting feeling? I've never been at this stage in my life before. What's going on in my mind? What are the physiological symptoms in my body? What is this a response to? It's not something that just immediately has to be medicated away or cured, you know. There's an importance in sort of going into that dark night of the soul and kind of staying there for a while, and that can be sort of embraced as part of human experience.
Well, and that really gets to the heart of like what psychoanalysis is. It's dialogue with the thing, right? You come into dialogue with it. And what was it that Carl Jung said? It's the demons you don't talk to that make you sick, right?
That's right.
All have the demons, and there's no, like, even Jesus. I mean, you can do an exorcism for demons, but really they're all like innate and part of you, just like pneumonia bacteria is in your lungs your whole life, right? And then it takes over if you don't talk to it. I think it's the same with the inner demons. If you have a balanced dialogue with it, then they don't make you sick. If you come out of balance, then the pneumonia takes over, right?
That's right. And some of the symptoms that some of the Freud and some of the early psychoanalysts discuss in their patients are just, you know, really fascinating. There was a guy who, in a case study I quote by Victor Tausk, who's an acolyte of Freud, who felt that there were legions of demons in his bowels that were digging pits and forming pieces of excrement and expelling them from his bowels. And it's just this kind of fascinating, like, Hieronymus Bosch-style image of the inside of the body that, you know, if you looked at it from an aesthetic point of view, is much more interesting than you know, most kind of clinical ways of describing depression.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. I haven't had them for a while, but there have been times in my life where I had nightmares, you know, fairly, not that frequently, but they were often very, very significant and very powerful and would kind of jangle me for days. And I used to go, God, something wrong with me. And then I started to really just kind of embrace them and even enjoy them, in the sense that I would wake up and I'd be like, wow, that was a really good one. That was just freak me out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I would find that even in the middle of them, in the midst of some horrifying, you know, apocalyptic invasion by, you know, alien viruses that were destroying the very fabric of reality and they were just about to eat me, I would have those moments of kind of dispassionate observation that you were describing, where it would be like, in fact, that particular dream I remember the most, you know, it's this total sci-fi, end of the universe scenario. And then just as they were about to, like, eat me, I thought, wow, they're just creatures like me and everybody else, just kind of trying to, like, make it work in the universe. And there was this kind of moment of, like, peace just before they, like, destroyed me. And it for me, it comes out of that a long practice of sitting with my own depression and my own anger and my own fear and paranoia, and really like not trying to run away with it, but having that meditative mind of just sort of being with it and looking at it, and you know, being aware of the difference between that and then going into it so far that you start to spin out of control. Of course, that's always a possibility. Yeah. Sometimes it just happens.
Those demons are a part of you, and to have a dialogue with them. I wrote in another book that I was in this pretty serious car accident, and in the middle of the accident, I must have been in shock to a certain extent, but I remember like sitting up, getting the car mirror, adjusting it so I could have a look, because I knew that like, you know, that I was covered in blood, and I wanted to take a moment, you know, just to remember. Mm. And that once I had that curiosity, the fear was gone.
Hmm.
That's amazing. That's a great story. Well, this is a really wonderful conversation. We're going to take a break here. This is Eric Davis. We're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network and talking to Makita Brotman, and we'll be right back after these.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Makita Brotman about phantoms in the clinic. Very spooky. Makita, so far we've addressed kind of the effects on the patient, and I was curious if you would talk a little bit about the therapists themselves. I mean, clearly if someone's going to be able to evoke darkness out of people, and even to have the wherewithal to set an environment like that, the therapist themselves has to be able to go into their own darkness. And I know you had said there's a very small amount of psychoanalysts now, what, like 3,000 or something. Mm. And to me, I mean, I think that really speaks to the amount of individuals that are left that are willing to go into the hearts of their own darkness. And can you talk about maybe some experiences you've had? I know you mentioned like you were able to go into your fear even in a car accident, but during a session, when you go into someone's darkness, do you see that reflected in your own ability to confront that in yourself?
Yes, and but one of the, I think what's even more interesting is on these occasions when an experience happens to me that is clearly an example of what Freud calls thought transference, where the patient will say something or will describe a dream where it's a reference to me to something that I've been thinking or I've been experiencing, and it's funny that I mean, I have a lot of examples of this that's happened to me, but there are very, very few that I can talk about on the air. Not just because of confidentiality, but also because there's a way that these that the patients will pick up on things in me that I'm embarrassed by, that I'm trying not to think about, that are kind of taboo, that are intimate and personal and private, and it's usually the thing that you're trying to push away that in this charged emotional atmosphere that the other person will pick up on. I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, I had a patient who doesn't have many dreams at all, and I was trying to encourage him to make a record of his dreams and to talk about them. And so he very, very rarely had dreams, and he had a dream in which he and I were together in a shopping mall, and we were walking through the mall, and I was very upset, crying, and he was trying to comfort me, and I didn't want to be in this shopping mall at all. And it just so happened that the following week, my mother and two nieces were coming to visit me from England, and I was a little dubious about that, but these two nieces were teenage girls, and what they wanted to do is to go to a shopping mall, an American shopping mall, and my mother had asked me if I would take them, and I loathe that kind of thing. I never go to shopping malls, and I dread it. And so I was, you know, as somewhere in my mind was this kind of dread of having to go to the shopping mall in a few days. So that's an example of something that, you know, it was clearly on my mind somewhere, even though in the present it wasn't actually at the forefront of my mind, but clearly this person had picked up on it. And what's interesting here is that the patient I was talking to lives in California. We were doing the session on the telephone, so we didn't even have any kind of face-to-face physical contact.
Wow.
So it's really fascinating when those things are transmitted so clearly in a way that's just, outside of the normal means of perception.
So I'm curious how much you have felt the need or not to come up with some theory to explain that. I mean, you do have a very interesting, theory in the book that I invite you to mention about the connection with the mother and that whole thing. But before we even get to that story, which is a very fruitful one, I'm just on a kind of more basic level, as you confront that evidence again and again.
Yeah.
Do you have this kind of almost scientific impulse like, wow, I have to figure out what this means in terms of my structure of reality, how reality works, blah blah blah? Or is there some sense that these things are almost have their own uncanny, unrecuperable otherness that you just, there's nothing to really do with? Or do you feel like you want to like figure out how to fit it into a worldview?
You know, at first when it happened, and this is kind of the impulse that led me to write this book, yes, I thought my natural tendency of thought, and I think this would be the same for anyone, would be to think, wow, if this can happen, then what are the implications? Then everything's changed. You know, this must have all kinds of implications for, you know, time and space and human relationships and relativity. And but the more I thought about it, the more I realized that I wanted a category to put them in that would bring me a kind of relief and an explanatory comfort. And I think, and part of my book is about how in the history of psychoanalysis, there have been various terms, theoretical terms have been invented. The one I talk about most is this notion of projective identification to explain things that otherwise don't really fit into any category. But I think it's a bad idea. I mean, I really think that in the end, these experiences, they're not predictable. They're not going to occur. There's no way of telling when or where they will occur. They only tend to occur in a charged emotional atmosphere, so then it's nothing that could happen in a laboratory. And there's this kind of sort of epistemological anxiety that develops around experiences like that that can't be categorized. And we have a tendency to say, well, we must, you know, develop a theory and call it this, and that will sort of safely explain those experiences. And I think even calling them, even saying that this is something that was created by the unconscious, you know, even calling it the unconscious is shutting out so many other possibilities that don't have a scientific name, and perhaps not even a name at all. I mean, that's why I like the word phantom, that it's the most evocative to me to think of these kind of phantoms that are in the air in certain when certain emotions are evoked in certain circumstances, but there's certainly nothing that we can control or categorize. And they certainly don't give us any comfort.
Well, I always like it, too, because if you go into the etymology of the word phantom, I love that word, too, and it's related to a fantasy, and a phantom or phantasm is related to light. And it kind of goes back to the word, like, trick of the light, which if you think about, like, how when we think of hypnotism, you always think of something like swaying the watch in front of someone's face, uh-huh, and that sort of flickering light. And it's almost like Brian Geisen's dream machines, like, uh-huh, the idea of that strobing light or darkness oscillating with light. And, I mean, that just goes back to kind of trance, really. So when phantom type of things happen, it's literally when you enter that liminal zone, kind of between consciousness, that the phantoms can be evoked. And I think like that kind of treacherous state that's necessary for these things to come in, that you can't repeat in a laboratory, that you can't like kind of plan out. I mean, back in shamanism, they would evoke them by doing these things to kind of alter your conscious state, which, like you said, it can be triggered emotionally, environmentally, like all these kind of things to let the phantoms come out through this like kind of manipulation, you know?
Yeah, and I think in the case of the schizophrenic in the street, their consciousness has been lowered by whatever medications they're on or whatever medications they should be on and are not taking, plus the, you know, the effects of the illness. and whatever cognitive deficits that creates, so they're sort of naturally going about in this state of heightened consciousness, which I'm sure can be incredibly painful and distressing. Mm. But it's like the shaman who has this knowledge through kind of preternatural means that other people don't really want to hear as they're walking past. It's the kind of thing that, you know, you're trying to push out of your mind.
Yeah, one of the things about that situation that I also like, and also has to do with the idea and the etymology of phantom as well, is that it's back out in the world. You know, it's you talk about in one chapter about how you know, we used to think that spirits and demons and things were, you know, out in the world, the same physical three-dimensional world that we see other people in, and that's where that stuff lived, and that with the rise of modern science and psychology, these things go inside and they change, but they still have this uncanny power, and some people acknowledge it more than others, but it's still the case that these things are inside. Even for your average, you know, New Age Jungian person, if you ask them where the archetypes are, they're inside. You know,
right.
you might see a glimpse of them outside or something that symbolizes them, or maybe you have a synchronicity that seems to, you know, connect inside and outside. But the whole situation of the guy in the street or the therapy room, it's like it's so clear that it's not just inside. And then when you think about the word phantom, which I also love because of its etymology, because of particularly with phantasm, is that the idea of the phantasm in a kind of for ancient psychology was precisely the thing, the image that moved from the outside world into your mind, that what it was that when you look out in the world and you see a tree and you think, ah, tree, and then like later on you remember, ah, tree, I remember that tree. What's happening is that there's a thing in the world, it sends a ghost of itself, a phantasm, into your eye, goes through your eye, into your brain, where you have a little phantasm collector. And so the term itself already brings us into this place that's like, both inside and outside,
that's
neither
right.
Inside and outside. And that's, to me, it feels like where we're getting close to something really interesting and strange again after
and
150 years of psychology.
And also, one of the definitions of psychosis is the inability in a person to determine what's coming from inside of their brain and what's outside, what's coming from outside. So the hearing of voices or constant paranoia, which is kind of, you know, paranoia is sort of the telepathy with a minus sign, you know, it's kind of the other side of telepathy. So that inability to distinguish within and without, it's the hallmark of psychosis, but it's also, you know, the hallmark of shamanism and you know, religious ecstasy as well.
Well, and that projection of the phantom, too, has to do with that as well. I mean, the first movies with magic lanterns were called Phantasmagoria, right? And that was projection of images from light. So, I mean, it's that inside, outside, like, is the movie real, or is it real in your phantasm collector, like Eric said,
or
is it getting projected into your head by someone else? Like, the whole idea of the black magician is that they could project these images into your head and make you crazy.
And in fact, you know, in his early work, Freud says that, you know, the whole point of psychoanalysis is to understand that we don't really relate to a world of objects and people. We're always relating to our own projections, and we project into the world, you know, our own imaginary companions, alter egos, spirits, gods, transitional objects. We're not relating with each other. We're actually relating with projections from our own memories, from our own minds, and you know, the people that we've known in the past. And we kind of project this scrim over reality and watch our own light show, like the people in Plato's cave.
Do you find that that in your experience of being a therapist and having gone through analysis yourself, that is there an end to it? Is there a kind of real healing in the way in the shamanic environment? You know, there's the desire to really heal, where like this person no longer is afflicted with whatever psychological or physical malady. And that was always, you know, of course, that's part of the critique that you hear from, you know, whatever more cognitive science-based psychologists. So how do you see it from your perspective? Is it just a deepening of life, or is there real healing?
I think, you know, for people, for most people who have, like, a situational depression, I don't think psychoanalysis is the answer. I think psychoanalysis for people who are fairly introspective, who are pretty mentally stable, perhaps who don't have any immediate pressing problems and who want to understand themselves more and more deeply in the same way that, you know, you might get by reading philosophy or perhaps studying Buddhism, just a kind of a further understanding of the self and by implication other people as well. So I see it as more of a kind of humanistic endeavor. I don't like to see it as a healing or a curative phenomenon, because that puts it in the realm of medicine and in the realm of kind of correctives and you know, plastering over things and restoring things. I mean, it's quite possible that if you enter a course of psychoanalysis, you're going to get less functional and less happy, in inverted commas, than you were before. But I think it's more a question of sort of lifting the veil and seeing what's behind the veil. And it might not be a pretty sight, but it's the truth. You know, so it's a question of kind of facing the truth. And I think questions of, you know, good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, just are kind of irrelevant at that point.
So it's the wrong question to, or the wrong metaphor.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's not. I don't see it as a process of healing, but more a process of deepening introspection, deepening self-understanding, looking into the human condition, which is, you know, never a pretty thing.
Do you think that this approach to these issues that you have here also help illuminate, like, parapsychology? I mean, parapsychology is such an interesting world, and you talk about it, and you talk about some therapists who are also interested, you know, in a more like strictly kind of hunt for the paranormal. But do you think that the perspective that you're bringing here helps illuminate or helps you understand what's happening for those people who are really trying to nail these things down?
Yeah, it helps me understand, and I'm really interested in the work of Stephen Browdy. I don't know if you've had him on the show, but he's really fascinated by this kind of stuff, and he has this an article about how parapsychology sort of looks for these things to manifest themselves in experimental test conditions, and then just not going to happen that way. You know, it's not possible. They're not predictable. They don't fit any rules or laws, and they're only going to manifest themselves in conditions of sort of emotional upheaval, which are, you know, necessarily not something that you can establish in a clinic or a laboratory. So I think it helps me to understand why parapsychology will probably never be scientifically respectable, and while parapsychologists will continue to do their experiments and will continue to, you know, have interesting kind of marginal results, but will never be sort of part of the scientific mainstream, the same as psychoanalysis. I mean, there's a very interesting kind of parallel between the histories of the two. They're both on the fringes of academia. They're both on the fringes of science. They're both repressed. They're both almost obsolete, but again, they both kind of keep sticking at their heads and keep returning in fascinating ways. You know,
well,
of course, whatever's repressed will strive to return.
That's a really important point. And I mean, honestly, I think diseases act that way too. They
don't act
the same way they do in a laboratory. You can have your little petri dish of Ebola, but you release it into a population and it is not going to behave the way that you statistically extrapolated in your measurements in the lab. And I think that if people can include more of this kind of active supernatural, so they call it, which, I mean, supernatural really is just what happens in nature and not in the laboratory.
Yeah.
But if they can apply that in psychoanalytical things also to the way infectious diseases work, I think that it would, because infectious diseases work in very supernatural, weird ways, how they spread and mutate and kind of can alter, and scientists cannot see them coming and changing. And then when they do, they're like, oh, this is weird. Like, now we have a super virus. And, and they can't understand how it happened, and they can't replicate that in the laboratory either.
And another parallel is the notion of resistance, because the analyst Adam Phillips says that he has a theory that that people's natural reaction to psychoanalysis is to resist and to say, oh, that's a load of rubbish, I'm not interested in that, I don't want anything to do with it. And when you get resistance, that shows that psychoanalysis is really healthy. So the fact that it's almost obsolete, the fact there's only 3,000 psychoanalysts left, in some respects suggests that, you know, it's really healthy because everyone is in resistance, that resistance is working, you know, under the surface somewhere.
That's awesome.
I'm curious, is there some commonality for the people who come to you, like the people who at this point, when it's so weird, who decided to pursue it?
Yeah, that, I mean, I don't really, I have a, you know, day job in the university as well, so I tend to work with people who know me. I don't like the kind of, I don't really see any distinction between the clinical and the personal, so sometimes they're my friends, sometimes they're people who've read my work and got in touch with me or been referred by someone else, but they usually know what they're in for. You know, I don't kind of take people who kind of come off the street, and I don't really advertise, so I'm working with people who I know outside of the clinical situation as well, which is actually how, you know, how Freud originally worked with his and his colleagues. You know, he worked with writers who recommended one another and who were part of his social circle as well. So I don't really believe in the, I think the phrase clinical is sort of a red herring in some ways. I mean, I don't know any difference between knowing someone as a person and knowing them clinically. You know, it's the same knowledge.
And that's the intimacy thing that you were talking about earlier, too. Yeah.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, Nikita, and I've enjoyed following your work and the various books that you've written very much. I'm kind of curious where your sites are focused on now. I mean, are you going to continue your hunt for the sort of pathological sublime, or where are you looking?
I have a book coming out next year, and I think I mentioned this before, Eric. It's a series of books put out by Reaction in England, and each book is on a separate animal. So they're like 30,000 words, they're small books, and my book is on the hyena. And so I've spent a year studying hyenas, spent some time in Africa this year studying spotted hyenas in Tanzania. I went up to Berkeley where they've got a spotted hyena colony, and I've just basically become hyena obsessed. There's something really compelling and fascinating about them. Again, they're like a repressed, marginalized creature. They're sort of neither cat nor dog, this kind of strange combination of the two. They laugh, they are scavengers, they prowl around in the dark, they're tricksters. They have a really, really bad reputation, whereas in fact they're pretty affectionate, intelligent animals. But there's just something about them that's just really fascinating to me, and I've been spending years on the trail of hyenas.
Oh, that's wonderful. Are there tricksters stories about folklore about hyenas
in Africa? Yeah, in Swahili. I mean, the hyena is like, there's a lot of stories with hyena and hare, and the hyena is the fool, the girl of the stories, and the hare is the smart one. So that, I mean, they're not tricksters, but they're kind of shapeshifters, and in some African countries, witches are considered to fly around on hyenas, so they play the role that, like, the black cat plays in Western occult lore. And they're associated with sex magic, too, because they're often considered to be, because the female hyena, spotted hyena, has a pseudo-penis that's bigger than the male's penis, so they're associated with all this kind of sex magic and sexual ambivalence. So really interesting, really interesting phenomena and fascinating creatures.
Well, how is it for you to look at something that also is very much, you know, nature, you know, like as opposed to these zones of the human mind and the sort of pathologies of culture? I mean, obviously, our cultural stories about hyenas are important to your story, too. But that must be also kind of different to look at nature directly through your interests.
I mean, part of the theory of these animal books is that we don't see nature directly. You know, we never see nature directly. It's always through... We're always looking at it through this scrim, whether it's zoology or anthropology or and taxonomy, that we don't really have a direct relationship with nature. So it's looking at, you know, I'm looking at how hyenas have been seen throughout every culture and how they've been depicted in art and how they've been sort of used in zoology and how they're used in illustrations and particularly used in kind of political cartooning to represent evil landlords or you know, financial bankers, and So I don't think there is, I don't think we really do have, ever have a direct relationship with nature, but we can sort of get further and further through this cultural undergrowth in search of that direct relationship. But I think it always eludes us because, you know, because we're in it ourselves. We are animals ourselves. We're part of nature ourselves.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I was just thinking about how, you never get there entirely, but you can get closer. It's like a spectrum. I mean, you can spend all your time in the mall, or you can go to the, like, you know, the savannah and, like, try to engage the thing, and it's like, it just takes you out. It's a less humanly constructed world around it. I mean, there's always that element, that filter, that scrim, that's a projection, that's a story, but it also feels like there's something primal about that encounter that maybe, you know, but maybe that's just the unconscious sneaking around and inviting me, you know, from the other side. So.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I mean,
we have to wrap it up. So I want to thank you very much, Makita.
Well, thank you for having me.
And people can go to Makita Brotman, BROTTMAN.com to read more and see more about her books and her articles. So from me and Maja, keep your minds open.